Hello. In my last lecture, I talked about the development of intensive political and economic systems in the Levant, on the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, in what's now primarily Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria. What I was particularly emphasizing in that case was the development of models which explain a sort of a political cycling, a steady oscillation between periods of greater political scale and centralization and urbanism, for example, in this region, and periods when political power as well as populations seem to have become more dispersed. And this may well, in the Levant, have to do with the relationships between fairly intensive sedentary farming systems and more dispersed pastoralist lifestyles. I now want to move on to a different region and a different topic, the development of states in the Eastern Mediterranean, on the islands, and along the coasts of the Eastern Mediterranean, and more generally of the Minoan and Mycenaean civilizations. These are extraordinarily interesting and significant societies for the history of the Mediterranean basin and the lands around it. So I want to do this both because of the intrinsic interest of these societies, which in somewhat indirect ways seem to have influenced classical Greek civilization, at least, and because we can again see the development of some different characteristics of state-level societies, particularly with Minoan civilization. So I want to again try and get a sense of the diversity of possibilities in these developing states. There's good archaeological evidence for trade connections between the Levant, the area I talked about last time, Anatolia in central and southern Turkey, and the island societies of the Eastern Mediterranean during the Copper Age and the Bronze Age. And again, I talked about these periods last time. In fact, the earliest known archaeological sites in the Eastern Mediterranean are on Cyprus, and particularly an extraordinary site, which I must mention, Akrotiri Etakremnos on Cyprus, which dates to almost 12,000 years ago. People at that point, at that site, were hunting dwarf elephants and dwarf hippopotamus, which seemed to have evolved on Cyprus through a process that biologists call island dwarfism, through isolation on the island over hundreds of thousands of years. And in this particular case, this is a situation in which animals on small islands with relatively limited resources evolve dwarf types more or less as an adaptation to a lack of resources. So these elephants on Cyprus being hunted by humans 12,000 years ago, weighed in at about 400 pounds, which is a fraction of the 12,000 pounds of an adult African elephant today. So the idea of these Eastern Mediterranean hunters and gatherers 12,000 years ago hunting elephants the size of calves and hippopotamus the same size is, I think, just generally interesting. More specifically for the course, this testifies to the capabilities of people to undertake substantial sea voyages at even that very early period. And, of course, the sea and abilities of humans upon the sea is going to be an important element in the development of Mycenaean and Minoan civilization in the Eastern Mediterranean. All of these islands had been gradually colonized through the Neolithic with early farming sites like Kyrakatia, again on Cyprus, and Knossos on Crete, dated to the 7th and 8th millennia BC. Obviously, such colonization required, again, this fairly developed seafaring capability, and we see the evidence of these extensive trading networks between the mainlands, around the Eastern Mediterranean, and Crete, Cyprus, and other Eastern Mediterranean islands, certainly by 7,000 BC or thereabouts. As a sort of a archaeological note, I will say that central to the study of these trading networks is the systematic analysis of archaeological materials that can be traced to original, discrete, local sources. Now, this is particularly certain types of stone, for example, certain kinds of flint, and most importantly of all in this region, obsidian or volcanic glass. Stone tools made of obsidian can often be traced chemically to the particular volcanic flows that they were taken from. And so being able to trace obsidian from certain sources to sites across the Eastern Mediterranean gives a very useful picture of trading networks more generally. Later, copper, especially from sources on Cyprus, would play a similar role. This is one of the fundamental ways in which archaeologists trace the movements of materials in the past. If you remember when I was speaking about the development of complex political and social systems in Mesopotamia, I talked about highly decorated Halafian ceramics, where similar kinds of analysis, examination of the detailed form of the pottery, as well as the characteristics of the clay used to make it, indicated that it was coming from a relatively restricted set of sources, some localizable in a very precise way, which implied in this case that Halafian pottery was being made in certain areas by specialist potters and then being distributed as a prestige good. The same is true, for example, of some of the materials, for example, copper ore in the Uruk trading network in Mesopotamia as well. So obsidian from eastern Turkey is found on some of the earliest Neolithic sites on Cyprus, while obsidian sources on the Greek island of Melos provided materials for communities on both the Greek mainland and the Aegean islands for a very long period of time, even before Melos itself was colonized, occupied by humans. Actually, perhaps as much as 6,000 years before the island was colonized. We can't think of these farming communities then, these Neolithic and Copper Age farming communities, as developing in isolation. They did not. Rather, they interacted in a widespread web of economic and cultural interchange, while still developing their own unique characteristics through time. It seems in some ways that dependence on sea routes actually facilitates this exchange in important ways. It seems to really generate the necessity and the possibility of long-distance trade, long-distance cultural interchange between a whole variety of different kinds of communities from time periods that are often surprisingly early. Thus, cultural influences from all of the different mainlands around the Eastern Mediterranean, from the Levant, from Anatolia, what's now southern Turkey, from Egypt, and from Greece, were variously important at different periods in prehistory, as of course was also the interchange between the islands of the Eastern Mediterranean itself. There seemed to be, for example, particularly close ties between developing Neolithic farming communities on Cyprus and the farming populations of the Levant, of the Eastern Mediterranean coast, some of which I spoke about last time, and populations in southern Anatolia, in what's now Turkey. These trading and exchange linkages seem to have yet again intensified during the 4th millennium BC, at the very end of the Neolithic period, the end of the 4th millennium BC. And so this is a significant time. This is a extraordinarily important period in human history in this part of the world. It's the same time as the late Uruk period in Mesopotamia, the same time as the late pre-dynastic in Egypt. And we see then as well this intensification of trade and cultural interchange in the Eastern Mediterranean. This intensification seems to have gone along with an increase in the scale of settlement on at least the larger islands of the Eastern Mediterranean. Smaller islands remain constrained by their carrying capacity, and prehistoric populations on many of these islands never exceeded a few thousand people. I should explain here what I mean by carrying capacity. When I'm speaking about carrying capacity, I'm referring to the potentials that different environments may have in terms of resources, and the capacity of those resources to support human populations. Small islands generally have relatively restricted resource bases. Actually, from this point of view, there are some parallels, strangely enough, between those dwarf elephants on Cyprus and the fact that on some of the islands, the smaller islands of the Eastern Mediterranean, large human populations could not be supported. It's a matter of resources in both cases. Not merely resources at any one time as well, we have to note, but the vulnerability of these small, relatively homogeneous environments over time. What happens during periods of drought? What happens during resource crashes? So generally, small islands, and we see this in different parts of the world, we see it, for example, in Polynesia. The colonization of Polynesia, small islands have generally restricted resources, and so they can't support so many people. This intensification at the end of the 4th millennium BC probably occurred in parallel with that of the Eastern Levant, as we saw last time, with developments in farming allowing increases in population densities in some regions. This likely involved increased exploitation of cereal crops, particularly, perhaps assisted by more intensive manuring systems, as well as the spread of fruit growing, particularly olives and grapes, during the succeeding Copper Age or Chalcolithic period. One issue we have to keep in mind as well here is the role of fishing in these societies. It seems likely the one impulse towards the initial occupation of some of the Greek islands was actually the exploitation of a tuna fishery among those islands. However, fish bones often don't preserve very well on archaeological sites, and so we often have a relative lack of information on the actual magnitude of both fishing and the consumption of fish by ancient populations. It's pretty obvious that there was a lot of fishing going on in later times. Paintings on Minoan sites, for example, demonstrate that. But it's hard to say what role it played in the Neolithic and directly afterwards. At the same time, Anatolian influences around the Mediterranean from what's now southern Turkey, which had been significant since the introduction of agriculture thousands of years before, became even more important. It's unclear at this point if that actually involved population movements out of Anatolia, if we can actually say that people are migrating from what's now southern Turkey onto the islands of the Eastern Mediterranean, Cyprus, Crete, Rhodes, and so on, or if these are cultural influences. This corresponds with a period, I will note, of considerable population growth and political centralization in southern Turkey itself, with the growth of small city-states there, associated with a not very well-known group of people called the Hatti. This area of southern Turkey would, during the second millennium BC, be incorporated within the Hittite Empire, that rival to Egypt under Ramses II at Kadesh, at the Battle of Kadesh in Syria. And the Hittite Empire would continue in later time periods to play a very significant role in the lives of peoples of the Eastern Mediterranean, just as the Egyptian state did. So, population growth, Anatolian influences, and probably contacts with the Levant, the Eastern Mediterranean coast, and Egypt as well, led to a number of developments in different parts of the Eastern Mediterranean between about 3200 and 2100 BC. Again, in the chronology of this area, this is the period known as the final Neolithic through the Chalcolithic or Copper Age and to the early Bronze Age. So we see different cultural traditions now in different parts of the Eastern Mediterranean, both on the islands and on the Greek mainland. And these traditions include what's known as the early Helladic tradition on the Greek mainland, the Cycladic culture in the Aegean, with very distinctive ceramics and extraordinarily beautiful, almost abstract, if you like, marble sculptures, which are best known, unfortunately, through looted examples from unknown sites. And Cycladic culture sites on the Aegean islands are some of the most targeted and most damaged by looting in this whole area. So we have the Helladic culture on the Greek mainland, the Cycladic, the Greek islands, the early Minoan, or as it's called, pre-palatial period. I'll talk about this term, pre-palatial period, occupations on Crete, and finally, the Arimi or Embelecu Copper Age occupations on Cyprus. So a diversification of cultural traditions across the various islands of the Eastern Mediterranean and on the Greek mainland during this time period. And this, of course, as I noted, is part of a larger sphere of cultural and economic interchange that also took in what's now Turkey, the Levant, and Egypt as well. There are some common themes in all of these areas of the islands and Greek mainland. During the third millennium BC, there continues to be good evidence for population increase across the Eastern Mediterranean during this time period. So one of these common factors then is a continuing increase in both site size and site number on the mainland and on the larger islands. As I said, some of the smaller islands simply do not have the resource base, the carrying capacity to support much larger populations. But on the larger islands like Crete and Cyprus, this certainly, this process of population increase seems to have continued. Some of the largest settlements during this period, like Knossos on Crete and Skarkos on the island of Ios, should be thought of as large villages or small towns. And they're significantly larger than any earlier settlements in the region as a whole. At the same time, site size is quite variable. It's not as if these large sites are the only ones that we find on the Greek islands during this time period. Smaller hamlets dominate in some periods and in some areas. In other regions, as on Crete, for example, we may actually be seeing the beginning of a two-level site settlement hierarchy. Probably has to do with varying environments on the different islands. We have such a diversity of size and resources that they provided very different opportunities for settlers. Evidence from tombs during this period, and tombs are more often excavated than habitation sites across the regions, indicate that some degree of social hierarchy was beginning to develop on at least the larger sites through the region, with some people buried with much richer grave goods, usually in the form of fine ceramics or metal objects, than were other people. While prestigious copper and later bronze artifacts, including daggers, pins, and axes, existed and were exchanged in a network of prestige, exchange, and competition between these different community elites. And what I want to note here is the similarity with the processes that I talked about with the model, for example, that Tom Levy advanced for similar periods in the Levant during my last lecture. Thus, early Bronze Age communities, like Lerna on the Greek mainland with its House of the Tiles, dated to between 2500 and 2200 BC, frequently included large central buildings. The building at Lerna, for example, is 25 meters or almost 80 feet long by 12 meters or nearly 40 feet wide. Now, it's a large, complex structure. It's a two-story structure with a tile roof, whence its name, House of the Tiles. Tiling is a high-value addition to any building in this part of the Eastern Mediterranean, even into much later periods, even into the Greek classical period as well. The function of the House of the Tiles is unclear. But the presence of these sites and their large structures is usually taken to indicate the existence of some central political authority of some sort. The House of the Tiles is often called a palace, by analog to later Minoan and Mycenaean sites, although perhaps safer would be to call it an administrative center. Other archaeologists theorize that this may have been some sort of communal structure, that this may not indicate any kind of political centralization at all. And it's really going to take more archaeological research, work on the ground, survey and excavation on these early Bronze Age sites in the region to get much more than speculation on these topics. Similar structures, although far less well preserved, existed on Crete over the same time period. For example, at Vasiliki on the east of the island, where we have two large structures dating to about the same time period, the middle of the 3rd millennium BC. They're comparable in size at least, although they're in far worse shape, subject to more destruction through time than the House of the Tiles at Lerna. On the Greek mainland, these 3rd millennium BC sites, these population centers, are often fortified, which obviously has implications for the development of conflict between communities on a fairly large scale warfare as well. But the form of political authority through these sites of the middle of the 3rd millennium BC is unclear. Researchers working in this area often suggest that it's during this time period, during the 3rd millennium BC, that, as we might predict, chiefdoms appeared in the Eastern Mediterranean. And we might note again the ubiquity of this term, chiefdom. However, we probably should not think of this process as the unopposed march of political centralization toward the ultimate goal of the state. In the Levant, during my last lecture, I talked about one alternative way to thinking about this, the idea of cycling between periods of political centralization and periods where political authority was more dispersed in the region. But there are other ways to think of it as well. Archaeologists working on cemeteries from the end of the Neolithic and early Bronze Age in the Eastern Mediterranean detect social tensions in these societies between, on the one hand, communal identities, and on the other hand, individual or group claims for elite status. It's notable that when we look at cemeteries from this time period, mortuary practices often submerge individual identities within that of the group through, for example, communal burials. And when you think about it, communal burials are an effective way of, if you like, enforcing egalitarianism after death, of imposing a common view of the ancestors, not as individuals with various degrees of wealth and power, but of a communal notion, a rather undifferentiated notion of the ancestors. So we see during these time periods in the 3rd millennium BC, we still see the continuation of these communal burial practices. But in some cases now, we begin to see some areas of these communal tombs are sometimes set aside for individual burials with prestige goods. To me, that indicates some ambivalence in these communities, in these prehistoric communities, about these changes in status. And this is part of a larger issue as well. As I said, we can't necessarily assume that there's going to be an unbroken, unresisted march towards social hierarchy and political centralization in Mediterranean societies or in those elsewhere, that everyone's going to agree that it's going to be a good thing to have wealthy people, powerful people, directing for their own purposes to a great extent the actions and goals of the community as a whole. That may sound like a very good idea to those people who are wealthy and powerful, but it may very well not to anyone else. So we have to think about what's going on, these processes of social hierarchy, of increasing social hierarchy and political centralization. We also have to think of these as forms of social struggle between, on the one hand, groups of people trying to gain access to increased resources for themselves, very often an increased proportion of community resources that they're trying to gain control over themselves as members of a developing elite, and those other people who are trying to protect what they have. More generally, there would certainly be people in these ancient societies actively resisting the breakdown of more egalitarian and more localized social forms and identities that seem to have existed in earlier times, for example, earlier in the Neolithic. A concentration on the large houses and elite sites in these periods is also a concentration on the winners in social processes that may have been pretty brutal for those people who were involved as losers. The relationship between these early Bronze Age people and later Greek occupiers of the islands remain disputed. It's likely, for example, that many of these people did not speak Indo-European languages, those languages that include Greek, the Romance languages, English, and in fact most of the languages of Europe today. This is because it's going to turn out that some of the later writings in the region were not originally in Indo-European, and are in fact are hard to relate to any other languages known anywhere. They're linguistic isolates. So we have to think about a linguistic geography, a language geography in the region, quite unlike that that exists there today. And this is one component of larger debates about the degree of cultural continuity in the Eastern Mediterranean from the Neolithic to the Bronze Age. In my next lecture, I'm going to look at the further development of these societies on the islands of Eastern Mediterranean and in mainland Greece, and the development to what we see as Minoan and Mycenaean civilization. Thank you.